Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Yield. Make sure to subscribe to the show and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, and leave a review if you're enjoying the content. In case we haven't met before, I'm your host, Peter Kerr. I'm the Director of Product Marketing here at YieldTree. Today, I'm joined by Richard Excel, who is an Instructor of Finance at the University of Illinois' Geese College of Business. Prior to joining the faculty at Illinois, he was a Senior Portfolio Manager at Wolverine Asset Management, where he ran a global equity long-short hedge fund portfolio. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. Certainly a topical conversation as, January was one of the worst Januaries over the last, 15 years or so. Second to, only 2009 or so. So certainly a bit of a rough start to start the year. So we certainly want to get your thoughts on how people should be thinking about the markets, where to maybe take some appropriate levels of risk or where those opportunities might be becoming available. But before that, maybe you could walk everyone through a little bit around your background.
Sure. So I started my career on the sell side, on the investment banking, in trading and foreign exchange and Asian emerging markets derivatives trading. That was back in the 90s. And I spent most of the 90s in Asia, in Tokyo initially, and then Hong Kong and Singapore. And then I wanted to pivot at the end of the 90s or 2000 onto the buy side. So I moved into the world of hedge funds. I came back to the US and I spent the next 20 years working at primarily UBS O'Connor, which was the first hedge fund, and then Wolverine Asset Management, which you talked about. And at those hedge funds, I worked on a number of different strategies, equity long short, as you mentioned, but also global derivative strategies and global macro. And I tried to implement or think about the world through all of those different lenses and not just try to myopically think of it as only one investor class tends to. Fortunately, I was able to retire in 2020 to focus on teaching. And now I'm teaching finance at University of Illinois, where I teach a variety of classes from portfolio management to investment research to derivative strategies, et cetera. I also do a lot with the CFA Society of Chicago, including hosting our podcast there, which is called the Investment Exchange Forum. And fans of this podcast, please tune in because we're trying to do similar sorts of ideas. And then I write a blog for the CME group called Excel with Options. And I write every day on LinkedIn about things that are going on in the markets that just trying to help demystify the world of finance or demystify finance. And that's kind of what my passion is these days, is to try to bring the ideas of everything I've learned in my career to every person that I can think of.
And with that background, especially as you think about it in the context of kind of demystifying, investments, which, sometimes are very straightforward, but sometimes there are a lot of things that kind of exist beneath the surface that people would likely benefit from kind of peeling back. But, in your experience, both on the buy side, as well as kind of taking more of an educational bend nowadays, what are some things that have kind of really contrasted between those two kind of ways to think about markets?
Well, I think first of all, every investor, regardless of where they sit in the spectrum, has a bias, right? Whether it's a retail investor, an institutional investor, everyone has biases. And some of these biases are structural, especially at the institutional level. The biases are structural because either it's the offering memorandum or investor policy statement or something in the way people have kind of learned through their careers. But there are structural biases that kind of create opportunities for other people. I think for retail investors, there's also similar sorts of biases. I mean, the one that kind of affects everyone universally is loss aversion, right? And you talked about January being a tough month. it's a tough month for everyone. It's a tough way to start the year if you're just got a clean slate as an institutional investor, but it's a tough way to start the year if you're just allocating to your 401k. So I think that bias is probably what's similar across the spectrum. I think what's different is, of course, what's always been different in the world of education versus industry versus, you know, institutional versus retail is access and, to information and the quality of that information that can help go into one's investment process. And so I think that's where I try to help, again, try to bring that kind of level that playing field a little bit and think about it that way. I don't think it's impossible for people who are doing things on their own, even if they don't have all the same information, to compete against the bigger players. It becomes a duration arbitrage at that point. If you have a little bit longer holding period, you can still survive. But I think those are things that are similar and different that I've noticed.
And you kind of mentioned a lot of these, inherent biases by these different constituents that invest in the market. You mentioned loss aversion in retail. What are some of the other big reasons for individual investors? What are some of the other big biases? And maybe you can also spend a second explaining what loss aversion is and how that potentially leads to other worse outcomes overall.
Sure. So by loss aversion, what I'm referring to is the preference, or I should say, for people, they get less enjoyment from gains than they get pain from losses. So let's say I bought something at $100 and it went up to $120. I'm going to be feeling pretty good. But if it went down to $80, which is the same percentage move, I'm going to be feeling more miserable than I was feeling good, if that makes sense. So what we would say is the utility is skewed a little bit differently. So we feel the loss, we feel the pain of losses much more so than we feel the joy of gains. And that's no different for institutional or retail investors, but that's something that we typically see. And so what does that lead to in terms of decision-making? Well, particularly what we see with retail accounts is people don't want to lock in that loss. They hold on and they hope that it's going to come back. And so that can lead to more problems because, you know, what do you call a stock that is down 90%? Well, that was one that was down 80%, then went down another 50%, right? And so holding on to losers sometimes can be the kind of the bane of anyone. And I think that we see that in institutions. I saw that in the world of trading. Again, trading, you have a very short-term duration, but when I would see the biases for institutions, they would have these trading losses and they would hold on to the positions. And we'd tell them that the worst thing that can happen is when your trade becomes an investment. If your duration is supposed to be short and you all of a sudden try to extend that and be something that you're not, that's usually when bad things happen. Or similarly, if you have a long duration horizon and you start being a little bit more active, which is kind of outside your realm. So you just want to ultimately be disciplined and stay disciplined to a process, stay disciplined to who you are. Some people like to trade more frequently. Others like to never trade. There's a lot of different ways to make money in this world. You just have to stay disciplined to who you are. And I think these biases take us away from our discipline.
And so to that point around, you know, the discipline, how important is it to kind of have, you know, an institutional IPS and maybe the analogy of that for an individual investor to kind of have a philosophy and a stated objective and then obviously try to work towards that? Or do you think that's something that really, you know, isn't as important for a personal investment portfolio?
Well, I don't know how formal it has to be. I think the formal IPS that institutions have is there to protect all parties, not just the investors, but it's there to protect the portfolio managers as well to make sure that, you know, as long as everyone's doing what they said they're going to do, then there shouldn't be any sort of hindsight. Hindsight is 2020, so there's no hindsight bias where people kind of come back and say, "Well, you didn't say that," and you're like, "Well, here it is in the document." I think for individuals, it's really just kind of understanding and knowing who you are as an investor, and understanding and knowing where you think you might have some competitive advantage. What I talk to the students a lot about is that you have a lot more access to information than you think you do. There's this understanding or assumption that we don't have as much information as the next person. Well, you know, if you're a Gen Z crowd, you're going to know a lot more about what Gen Z crowds are thinking than maybe a Gen X portfolio manager sitting in New York City. And so you maybe know a little bit more about what might be driving certain investment trends or even certain securities more so than that portfolio manager. I go to teach school in the heartland of America. I think the students in my class know a lot more about corn and soybean and food prices than most institutional investors do. And they probably don't even realize that. And so I think that's one of those things where there is that information, but you have to understand where you think your competitive advantage is versus someone else. And if you don't have an advantage, That's fine. That's what indexes are for. If you, you know, then you have to kind of really pivot and say, okay, I'm going to take, I have an appetite to take risk for the longer run. And so I'm going to just kind of stick with a more disciplined approach over a longer run, but where I think I might tactically have an advantage because of asymmetric information flow, then certainly if that makes you comfortable, that's what you should do.
So that's really good insight. Kind of thinking a little bit more then around what's going on currently, you know, certainly, you know, we saw a tough January. I was thinking maybe you could spend a moment or two just kind of setting the stage for what's going on in the markets and how come they're reacting the way they are. And then maybe we can talk about a couple of things that are happening under the surface that everyone might not be aware of being, you know, key drivers of maybe, you know, the rest of 2022 and into 2023.
Sure. So I my process has always been one that I break into three parts, and that kind of helps me think about the world and think about all the asset classes in a more disciplined and logical way. And the first part of what I like to think about is what I call the fundamentals. And most people think of the fundamentals as, oh, what's the PE of that stock? Well, that's not really fundamentals. What I think about when I think of fundamentals is what's going on in the economy, and not just in the US, but around the world. What's going on in the economy? What's driving that economy? What will continue to drive the economy positive or negatively? Because ultimately, economies drive earnings and earnings drive stocks, and stocks are the riskiest asset class that most of us follow. And so when I look at that fundamental trend, what we see is that it's actually still some positive stories out there, right? We're coming off of, you know, for most people's investment careers, historically high growth rates in the economy over the last 18 months or so. Yes, I think the consensus is that it's going to slow down a little bit, but slowing down from historically high levels, that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to have a crash or a recession, right? We saw a lot of the growth numbers yesterday came out, and yes, they softened a little bit, but they're still at really absolutely high levels. You know, what's been driving some of that strength in the economy has been certainly monetary and fiscal policy. And that's slowly getting removed. How slowly? That's the question for the markets. And that's what something that the markets are struggling with right now is, it, you know, is the Fed and other central banks going to be more hawkish and remove some of that too quickly? Is fiscal policy going to not get through the way we thought it was? And that was a driver. Is it really necessary? And are companies able to kind of now get on their own feet and navigate that? And so those are a lot of the questions that you want to ask yourselves. Again, getting to the idea of what's the fundamental? What's going on in the economy? Back to the idea where everyone has information. I think everyone can see in their economy around them what's going on and how strong the economy is. They know from the conversations with their friends that work in a variety of industries. And that's no different than what anyone from an institutional portfolio manager to a central banker is trying to do, right? The regional governors at the Fed are talking to people around them and trying to find out what's going on. And then that's something that we can be doing as well and getting that sort of information. So that's the first part of what I do. And that's the fundamental part of the tree. The second part, which I think has had a much bigger impact on what's going on this year, is what I call behavioral, or it's the supply and demand. You might have a positive trend, but you know, what's the near-term supply and demand, and what's driving that incremental supply and demand? And for that sorts of information, I look through a variety of different metrics, everything from survey data, whether it be investor surveys or company surveys. You know, we got the purchasing manager survey yesterday. I also like to look, given my background, I like to look at that the options market and see what the options market's telling us in terms of relative pricing, what's going on in terms of implied volatility relative to historic volatility. What does the shape of the VIX curve look like? What does skew look like? Because these are all things where, you know, in the options market, we use a fairly simple model, the Black-Scholes model, to price options. And so traders have to make adjustments to that model in order to reflect what's really happening. And if you look at those adjustments that they're making in terms of market prices, you can kind of get a little bit of a look into what's in their minds right now and what they're worried about and what they're concerned about. And then I also look at technical analysis, because I think to me, technical analysis is a great tool to measure behavior. It's a great tool to measure where that pain of loss aversion is creeping in. It's a great tool to measure where overconfidence might be creeping in. And I think there's a number of different behavioral biases that I can observe by using some technical analysis techniques. And finally, I look at flows such as M&A flows or IPO flows and things like that to get an equity fund flows to get a sense of where's the confidence. And then the final piece of the process is catalysts. And so, you know, you have some sort of fundamentals. You see these flows that are going on in the market and trying to understand those flows. But then what's the catalyst that's going to get people to change their mind, right? What's the catalyst that's going to get people to change that flow? And so when, for that, I look at three different things, really. The first is the, not again, looking at economic data, but from the standpoint of how is it surprising us? Is it coming in better than expected or worse than expected? You know, we have these models built out, which assume some sort of trend, as I talked about in the fundamentals, but is the incremental data, markets move at the margin. So is the incremental data positive or negative? The same is true with earnings. Earnings drive stocks. And so are we seeing better than expected or worse than expected earnings, better than expected or worse than expected sales? You know, trying to get a sense of what's going on in terms of sales margins and asset turns for companies, but seeing that through the lens of earnings surprises. And then finally, the last category I look at, which oftentimes, frankly, doesn't really matter, but sometimes it's the only thing that matters. And maybe it's one of those things that matters right now, is geopolitics. You know, geopolitics is always tends to be a negative, right? Other than the wall coming down in 1990, I can't think of a geopolitical incident that wasn't a negative incident in my career. And that's something where, you know, does what's going on in Ukraine and Kazakhstan and the Baltics, does that matter for investors? If it does, how does it matter? What should I be looking at? And so, again, it typically tends to not matter until it's the only thing the world focuses on. A great example in the last few years was COVID. You know, we'd heard about COVID in the markets in late 2019, even January 2020. The markets didn't seem to care until all of a sudden we got the first cases in New York. And then all of a sudden it was the only thing that people wanted to focus on. So that geopolitical catalyst, you know, understanding what's out there, but trying to understand what's the trigger to get people to care. And I think for that geopolitics right now, the key thing to people for people to look at is energy prices. The expectation is high with any commodity, high prices are the cure for high prices because supply is expected to come on demand and drive those prices down. But are there some structural reasons right now because of geopolitics where that won't come down? So those are what I look through. You know, the fundamentals are still pretty strong right now. I think from a supply and demand standpoint, we didn't have very much margin of safety. I don't get too caught up dogmatically in terms of the valuation at an index level, which a lot of people seem to think of. But let's be honest, if we look at it on an individual stock-by-stock basis, there wasn't a great deal of margin of safety. And so any sort of negative news that kind of came in certainly led to a little bit of volatility. And then volatility begets volatility because capital is allocated on Wall Street using a value at risk model largely, and volatility is an input. So as volatility goes up, risk has to come down. And so you look at those things and you see the supply and demand got pretty negative as we went through January. It got to an extreme negative as we are kind of exiting January into February. But then you look at the catalysts and earnings have been fine, but they've been fine every quarter, but it's kind of diminishing marginal returns, if you will. They're not surprising by as much as they had in previous quarters, but they're still doing okay. But the economic data, certainly here in the US, has been disappointing. It's been disappointing on the negative side. And so that's something where at the same time, we've got the Fed being a little bit more hawkish than maybe expected and more hikes being priced in. We're seeing economic data start to slow to where is there potentially a growth scare somewhere down the horizon? So those are the things that I try to think about and try to think about them in those categories. And then just try to weigh those across and see how it works, if that makes sense.
Yeah, just kind of like, you know, when you think about January and you think about kind of 2022, you mentioned a lot of, you know, slowing or moderating growth in earnings, but still obviously very positive and still, you know, in growth territory. Inflation was one thing you didn't mention. And I think it's certainly something that's in at least the top of mind for a lot of people. And, you know, I would just caveat that most institutional investors really think about inflation expectations more so than any, you know, single print, but maybe you can help, you know, discuss what's going on a little bit with inflation here. You know, there's obviously a debate about transitory or whether or not it's going to be sticky inflation. And also maybe if you could spend a second talking about the breadth of inflation drivers, is it really isolated to one or two or three key core categories, or are you kind of seeing consistent inflation across the board with all the underlying categories that go into the outputs?
No, that's a great question. And it's certainly been something I've been trying to focus on. So it's a little bit surprising I didn't mention it in that ramble. So yeah, I was certainly within the core when I talk about the fundamentals of the economy. I like to look at it. I try to break it down between growth and inflation as two different components. And so some will look at nominal GDP. I like to look at real GDP for growth and add the inflation, because what we've seen historically is when, you know, you have different phases of the economy that are going on that you would measure between growth and inflation. And so inflation is, it was the story for all of 2021. And it's been the story here we are in early 2022. Personally, I never quite felt it was transitory last year. Because I think that while there were some base effects early in 2021 that was leading central bankers and others to think that it could be transitory, for me, there was maybe some other fundamental drivers. I think, yes, there are a variety of things that have been driving inflation, but I'm actually kind of focused on a few different things, three different things. One of them is the energy prices, as I mentioned before. And economists like to say, well, energy prices are volatile, so they usually kind of take it out of the headline inflation statistic and they don't think about it. But for me, there's a few different things that are going on that might lead to a little bit structurally higher energy prices than before. I mentioned the geopolitics before, the supply that might not come on in Europe, and Europe has seen much higher energy prices than we have in the U.S. And even in the U.S., we look at our heating costs year over year are up 100%. Our gasoline prices are up over 60% year over year. I mean, we're seeing sharp increases in energy prices, but nothing like they've seen in Europe. And so we have the structural impediments of supply that might be coming on and might not be coming on in Europe. ESG investing is something that's near and dear to my heart. And it's something I think is a powerful theme that's going to be with us for quite some time. But if we're honest with ourselves, as we go through this energy transition, that's going to lead to structurally higher energy prices. As companies are encouraged to use less and less CapEx towards carbon and more towards alternative sources, which will come on stream later, that means near term, we're going to have structurally higher prices. If you just kind of look at and how that's filtered through, it started in Europe, it's come now into the US. That's another source of energy supply that could come online that isn't. And that's, again, maybe for the right reasons, but in the near term, that means we could see some structurally higher prices. And then ultimately, I think also, we're going to get an OPEC meeting here this week, but OPEC has been either hesitant or unable to really meet that incremental supply that's coming on. So to me, I look at it and say, maybe for a lot of reasons, either geopolitically, either fundamentally, or because of this ESG thematic, that energy prices might stay structurally higher. We're seeing the same thing in food prices too. Food prices are up year over year. And while that's another component that economists like to take out of the equation, it's something that most people spend the bulk of their food on, or bulk of their money on. Food and energy is what people spend their money on for the most part. And so especially as we're kind of thinking about returning to work and people will want to drive to stay safe, with higher gas prices, that leads, that's going to be, again, something that people are going to be factoring into the decision of whether they go back to work or not. And that's leading into the third point, which I don't think we're at that point yet, but the idea that can this inflation stay high long enough that it leads into wage expectations and therefore some sort of wage price spiral. Now that has a negative connotation because that's what we saw back in the 70s and early 80s. I'm not suggesting that we're there yet, but we've already seen that companies across the board have had to increase what they're willing to pay to try to get workers into work. And some of that, sure, some of that had to be because of incremental government stimulus. But at this point, it also has to do with the rational decision consumers are making of how much is it going to cost me to get to and from work? And, so how much do I need to make to have this be worthwhile? And so I think those are the things that I'm looking at. There's a lot of other components to inflation that I think, whether it be healthcare costs, education costs, owner's equivalent rent, things of that nature, that will have their impacts. I mean, used car prices were a big driver of inflation last year, and now they're going to be coming down. But how many people is that really going to affect, or how many people did it affect last year versus the food and energy, et cetera?
Very interesting. And taking all this into mind, right? And we've certainly seen a little bit of, I don't want to call it a true rotation because it feels like it's been a little one-sided and kind of more of a selling situation, but we've seen growth really underperform value, especially high growth, lower current cash flows / real earnings. And just kind of, projecting out into the rest of 2022, do you think a trend like that kind of continues? Do you think that, there's a little bit more of a rebound in growth relative to value? How do you think kind of the equity story kind of plays out for 2022?
Well, there's a couple of things that are going on to that. So the value versus growth debate often comes down to inflation, because when you think of value sectors or value companies, they're typically companies or sectors that are a little bit broken and don't have pricing power. And so when we get inflation, all of a sudden these companies with very high operating leverage get some sort of pricing power, and that can drop a lot to the bottom line. And so that's why we tend to see value do better than growth when we're in periods when inflation is picking up. And so that isn't really surprising. But on a sector basis, some of the things you talked about, which is that the high growth, the tech and the high innovation type of companies that were the most popular places for people to invest through at 2020 and into 2021, that's an interest rate phenomenon. So of course, interest rates and inflation are tied. But what's going on there is that it's the duration. So it's the duration of the equity market. If we look at the duration of the fixed income market, through it peaked in the insatiable demand for duration kind of peaked in the end of 2020, when the best example of that in the bond market was all of the, I think at the peak we had $18 trillion of negative yielding debt in the world. And that was investors, whether it be pension funds, insurance companies, banks, and central banks, of course, that were just had this insatiable demand for duration. And now then that triggered through, and we had all of a sudden this insatiable demand for duration in the equity markets. We saw that in the highest growth firms, the innovation firms that weren't generating any near-term earnings or any near-term cash flow, but had a lot of high future growth, where the entire value of the company was really on that kind of terminal value somewhere down the road. And now as rates go higher in a rising interest rate market, as we've seen with the 10-year rates moving higher, as you would see in fixed income, you see the same thing in equities, where people want to shorten their duration. They want to move to shorter duration vehicles. And what is a short duration vehicle in an equity market? Well, it's a company that generates a lot of cash flow and pays a lot of dividends. Sometimes it's a value company. Some of those same companies aren't necessarily value. I mean, I don't know if Procter & Gamble at 25 times earnings is considered value, but they generate a lot of cash flow and they pay dividends. Whereas these kind of terminal value, high terminal value equities, primarily in tech, but also in biotech, they struggle because your discount rate's going up and you bring the present value back to now, and it's just not worth quite as much. And so I think we're going through that adjustment of more rate hikes coming in, which affects the discount rate, which means that we're having this duration adjustment. That to me, we're getting to that point where that's probably not going to be as much of the story. I think it's just an adjustment phase that we're kind of going through here in the first quarter. Let's face it. In September, we had essentially less than one rate hike priced in for the next 12 months. And now we're at the point where we have slightly more than five rate hikes priced in. So we've had quite an adjustment on the discount rate in a very short period of time. And that's led to this kind of rapid transition from long duration to short duration across all markets. I think that my sense is we're kind of getting near to the end of that. Of course, yes, could it go up to six or could it go up seven? Yes, but zero to five is the painful part. Five to six or seven, that's going to be a little bit easier for the markets to digest.
So it's funny you mentioned this. It's one concept that I remember learning that always stood out to me, and I don't think it's as widely held, as just that people forget that their equity portfolios are more often than not their longest duration asset. But of course, it's the liquidity component that makes people feel as though they're really not long duration assets. But you know, for everyone, just kind of their knowledge, you know, when Rich is talking about the duration, you can think about a weighted cash flow model, where you just think about how much each cash flow you might get, whether dividends or when you ultimately exit the opportunity at the end, is weighted. And so something that's not paying any dividend or has no other cash flows, everything's really anchored on whatever that sale price is. Usually, you know, Rich, you can kind of clarify me, most people who underwrite or model out are looking about 5 to 10 years out or so. But really a company, it's a perpetual company. It's not, you know, you don't really model in that a company's ever going to go out of business, so it exists forever. So a really long duration asset relative to some other ones out there. So you talked a lot about, you know, kind of what's going on with the market. And I know it feels as though we're a little bit on the edge for kind of what the next move will be, whether it's a little bit more of a rebound or whether or not it could be potentially more pressure. Without answering that, unless you have a true opinion on the next direction, what are the key catalysts that you think about that could kind of dictate the next 6-12 months and what direction equity markets head?
Well, I think the key catalysts are, I mean, again, I kind of go back to my framework and say, is anything really changing in the fundamentals of the economy? Or the expectation is that growth is going to have this kind of slower glide path lower, but still stay positive. So think of it simply, we got the ISM number yesterday. 50 is kind of the expansion contraction level, right? And kind of the highest levels we've seen in the past have been around 60. We saw 60s or a little above 60 in 2020, 2021. It's still yesterday came in around 57 and a half. If we look at that, and as long as it stays above 50, as long as we stay in expansion, that's still going to be a healthy environment at some point for stocks. And so that's something I think you want to keep your eye on. If you just look at the ISM as one simple metric for the equity market, we know that when the ISM is rising, stocks do the best. And when the ISM's falling, as long as it stays above 50, stocks do have positive returns. But if it's falling and goes below 50, all bets are off. And so I think that whether or not that ISM is going to be forecasted to drop below 50 is something people wanted to keep their eye on. And that if you wanted to look at one single metric in terms of the fundamentals, the inflation and the inflation data that we get, that's going to impact Fed policy, which is going to impact the pace of discount rates. Now, I think a lot of that kind of pain and noise is has been priced in. Like I said, that if you look at the Fed funds futures market, the euro dollar market, a lot of that incremental discount rate has already been priced in, but it could get worse and maybe cause the Fed to have to act, 50 basis points at one meeting, which they're saying they're not going to do, but that would cause another source of concern. So I think you want to think about that. And then to me, I like to look at these supply and demand metrics to know when this is a buyable dip in the market versus something that maybe is a little bit more fundamental. And for that, I think you want to look at, if you're sitting at home, you can look at any sort of technical analysis charts you like to look at. We've gotten a little bit oversold, but as we kind of move back up, and we've had a nice couple of days to end January and start February here, how are investors responding? Are they adding to their hedges as we move higher? Or are they getting involved and they're buying the stuff that was beaten down the most? And so I think looking and observing how investors are reacting to this move as we've kind of come off the lows will kind of give us some idea of what the market psyche is. My sense is that we've kind of gone through a little bit of that adjustment and we're going to have, we're going to exit this earnings season and have a little bit better flavor through the rest of this quarter. But I still think that this is going to be the type of year that I'm sitting here looking out my window and seeing a lot of snow on the ground. It's going to be one of those years where the tires are spinning quite a bit and maybe we don't really go anywhere, but there's going to be a fair bit of volatility. I'm not suggesting that everyone wants to respond to that volatility, but I would just say that if you're worried about not having seen high prices to sell, you might get a chance to see those high prices. And if you're worried about not seeing those low prices again to buy, you might see those low prices again. So volatility can be your friend. It doesn't always have to be your enemy.
No, that's great. We've kind of talked around it, but I haven't really addressed yet the position the Fed's in. Certainly you mentioned that, they're certainly entering into a bit more of a tightening cycle where they'll both reduce some of their asset purchases, which is a form of tightening. And then also they will likely begin, the first rate here, I think in March, with the expectation at least over the next 12 months of, to your point, maybe three or so are priced in now for this year, and then certainly an additional two or so coming, to start 2023. Just kind of curious, how you can maybe think about, or how we can think about the Fed's position. How aggressive do they want to be to really knock inflation down? Knowing that they've always had historically a hard time keeping inflation up in the range of their mandate. How do they kind of think and balance that, you think? Because knowing that, we're still far away from full employment. We're seeing wage growth for really the first time in probably at least a decade or so, at least on a consistent and, really meaningful way. How do they balance and weigh all these different factors while also really not inducing a recession like they're historically known to do?
That's a great question. I mean, that probably is the question for 2022, right? And so, I mean, the Fed has a dual mandate, right? You mentioned both of them, price stability and full employment. We're a ways away from full employment. We might not get back to the employment levels we saw back in the kind of the peak in 2018 or so. And that might be because of some structural changes that COVID accelerated in terms of early retirements, et cetera. And that's something that I think everyone has. I don't know if anyone has a great handle on that. Everyone's trying to observe if people are going to go back to work or not, or if there's a wage price where people will go back to work or not. I think that's something where the Fed talks about being data dependent. I think we all have to be. We kind of have to watch and see how that plays out. And so that employment, but you would think since they're not full employment, the Fed might be a little bit more hesitant, but they're not being hesitant, right? They're telling you they're not going to be hesitant. And I think that's because the Fed probably, in my sense, got a little bit too cute. They thought they could let inflation run a little hot for a while because it had been below their 2% target for a long period of time. And so there, I think the feeling was, and a lot of the speakers mentioned, like, well, we can let it run hot around 3 or 4% for a little while. Well, what happens is it got away from them, right? It got up to 7% here in CPI. And so while they were comfortable, even through September, October of last year, to say, we can let it run hot for a while, all of a sudden you started to see some prints in CPI that I think really caught them by surprise, and where they felt, okay, let's face it, we're at historically low interest rates. And so even removal of some of that liquidity, whether it be quantitative tightening and or rate hikes, certainly would seem to make some sense given where inflation is running. And in inflation, ultimately, that's the key for this year, because this is a midterm election year. And while the Fed is in theory independent, you can imagine that every politician is calling up their whatever Fed governor they can get on the phone to tell them how their constituents are feeling the pain of this inflation. They're feeling the pain in food and energy prices. It's coming through slowly to wages, and maybe wages will catch up. I mean, even the Biden administration said inflation's not a problem as long as wages move up higher than inflation does. Well, they haven't yet, but you can tell that politicians care about that, and they're going to call their Fed officials. And so the Fed's caring about it because they lost their things. I think they think they're losing some control. And so, quantitative tightening is coming. It's already working through the system. And I know some people say that QT is not tightening, or tapering is not tightening. Well, in my opinion, it is, because if quantitative easing is easing policy, then removal of easing is certainly tightening policy. Now, how much of an impact that's going to have in terms of the markets, I think probably not as much, essentially because they're still doing something, they're just not doing as much. And so the rate hikes are probably going to have a much more of an impact. But again, that's kind of getting priced in to where we have 5 through the next 12 months. So I think that the Fed is absolutely responding, and it being an election year, I think is not surprising. I think we've mentioned, Europe before, and that's again, in a world where it's global capital flows, the ECB is going to probably have to consider acting because energy prices are really, really high there. And there's been a lot of liquidity provided by the ECB. And you've got elections throughout Europe. So politicians know that in election years, voters vote with their wallets, and their wallets are going to have a little bit less in it right now. And that's usually not a good feeling for a politician going into an election cycle. And so my sense is there's a political driver here that's going to certainly kind of keep the Fed in line here and try to, get them to want to curb inflation. Whether or not that leads to policy error, that's something that we kind of have to kind of see play through the system. And one other thing I would touch on there, where I think some of the what I hear in the market is people talk about how maybe demand was pulled forward into last year, and we're going to see a lot of inventory hit, and therefore prices really start to come down sharply. If that happens, and then that means the Fed doesn't have to be as aggressive, that would be positive. It's not clear that is going to be what happens, but that is a possibility, right? We've already seen that with the likes of Lululemon saying, yeah, we bought too much stuff and now everything's on sale. So if that is just one case of what we might see other companies have to do, that would potentially be a good story on inflation, because it would get the Fed to back off a little bit and allow riskier assets to do better.
That's great. And I did not know that about the Lululemon sale. So we'll certainly take a look there.
Yeah. I mean, they are literally calling their 40% off sale the "we bought too much" sale. So for those who are fans of the product, go online and take a look.
This has all been great, Rich. I want to thank you so much. Want to turn it to you for any kind of parting thoughts. You mentioned upfront how everyone can find you. Certainly the LinkedIn blog is how, I became aware of a lot of your writing. You mentioned some other outlets too, but any parting thoughts and anything else that maybe you drive people to in order to gain better awareness of the markets?
No, I would just encourage people to continue to listen to your podcast, because what you're doing is really helping them kind of figure out how to invest in the world. And hopefully, if you want to hear more about what I'm saying, like I said, I write on a daily basis on LinkedIn about different things I see in the market. And I do the Investment Exchange Forum podcast, and I do a blog with the CME Group. And I put all of that stuff on my LinkedIn. So if you follow me on LinkedIn, you'll see all of that. And ultimately, my goal is just to, like I said, to demystify finance, to really try to make it so that everyone can really understand what's going on out there and make better decisions in their own portfolios.
That's fantastic. And reminder for everyone listening, it's Richard Excel at LinkedIn. And I think your bio is currently a finance professor at University of Illinois. So Rich, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you to all of our listeners. Remember to visit YieldStreet.com to learn more about our offerings and come to realize your next level with us. And of course, subscribe to our YouTube channel so you never miss a show. Thank you and see you next week.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to YieldStreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at YieldStreet.com. Thanks again for listening and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7-10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at YieldStreet.com.